The committee meeting will come to order. And I have to do this too. Where is it? So I got it. If you could, everybody could turn off their cell phones and electronic devices, that would be great. Including me. All right. The purpose of today's hearing is to kind of use our new role here a little bit as not just a policy committee but an oversight committee. And as many of you might know, there were a couple of incidents recently in Montevideo and Albert Lea related to some abuse that went on in nursing homes that's garnered some media attention, and we just wanted to talk about that a little bit. But the focus really is not on those two cases per se, although that might come up a little bit, but really use those two cases as a place to jump off into talking a little bit more about what's going on in nursing homes and how we can prevent some of these issues from happening in the future, why some of this abuse might be occurring, and if other start to kind of think about, are there solutions, or is a solution needed at all, or are these isolated incidences? So really that's where we're headed, you know, and I think part of the oversight responsibility here is that we do have an obligation to protect some of our most vulnerable citizens, including the elderly in nursing homes, and those, we haven't done as much work in that area in recent years as I think we need to do. And so I think this won't be the only committee hearing that dwells and looks and into those issues, but it's a start on that. So with that, and that's true of elderly people, not just in nursing homes, I want to emphasize. This is a problem that goes beyond that as well, I think. So, Ms. Cullen and Ms. Thurlow, if you want to start things off for us. Oh, and we have a quorum. So there's some minutes in your packets as they're coming up to the testifying table. Representative Tao, do you want to move the minutes from January 13th?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Anybody have any comments, questions? All those in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right. Thank you, Representative Tao. Ms. Cullen.
Thank you, Representative Houston. My name is Patty Cullen. I'm President and CEO at Care Providers Minnesota. Thank you to Representative Houston and members of the committee for giving us the opportunity to talk about these very important issues. In addition to my role as CEO of Care Providers Minnesota, I also represent one of the facilities that has been most often in the media. They're a member of ours. And so I'm here to answer questions and to give some information that this committee may need that they still don't have on the situation that occurred down in Albert Lea, Minnesota. The Administrator Mark Anderson expresses his regrets. He was unable to be here today. Part of it is there's an arraignment tied to all of this next week, and there's a lot of media in the little town of Albert Lea right now.
There is a letter, members, in your files that Mr. Anderson sent to everybody, so you can take a look at that at your leisure.
And I think, thank you, Mr. Chair, and a lot of what was in that letter is, I'll highlight a few of the points here as the situation occurs here. So what I intend to do today is just kind of go through the timeline and some of the important points that I think this committee should understand about this. But at the onset, I want to make sure committee members understand from our perspective and from the perspective of the other testifiers you'll hear today, I think we all come from the same place, that elder abuse in any setting is unacceptable and won't be tolerated. The feelings that you may have had in reading the media reports and the emotional responses were probably the same across the board that I had, and that especially the administrator and management staff of that facility, as they dug deeper into the situation, felt. I have worked for about 18 years with the administrator and DON at that facility, and the emotional havoc, the investigation, and the subsequent findings have rendered on those really good, dedicated staff is something I really can't describe here today. To understand the timeline a little bit, the abuse was actually reported in Albert Lea around May 1st of this year. It had happened several months before, and it was reported by an employee that was terminated. And a couple of the questions that have been consistently asked in the media, well, why didn't you know about it if it happened in February until May? there's a paragraph in that letter that describes some of the reasons why, but also remember that as soon as it was reported by a staff, it was immediately action was taken by the facility administration. And within that same day, action was taken as soon as they knew about it. So the perception that when they knew nothing was done is incorrect. As soon as they had reports of potential abuse reported, they took action. They also, the final report from the health department was issued, I believe, in August. The reason the media didn't occur until December is that's when the charges were filed. And that's so you see a kind of a lengthy time frame throughout 2008 as a result. I believe December 1st was when the Freeborn County attorney filed the charges. Like I said earlier, the arraignment for the two that were charged with the majority of the crimes is next week. And so there'll be likely another series of media stories about this particular situation next week. I do want to also put on record a little bit about this facility that is part of the Good Samaritan Society chain of facilities throughout the state. They have, if you look at their records, whether it's the state report card or the Medicare five-star reporting system, they rank one of the highest in the state. They have 5 of 7 report card measures are the highest or above the state average, 4 or 5 stars on the Medicare.gov. They have also been the recipient of a national award through the STEP Awards program based on Malcolm Baldrige criteria, as well as some state awards. So we want to kind of put the facility itself in perspective here. The points I think are important for this committee is the reason this actually went through the process is because it was self-reported. And you will find from the other testifier here that these are incidents that were reported by the facility. This was not found in a survey process or a complaint. It was self-reported by the facility, and that's what led to all of the series of events that happened. The other thing I think that is very important is that the facility went a little bit beyond because they did insist. They requested the police to investigate, and they called back the county attorney to encourage them to press charges once they found out, based on the interviews, what happened. They went above and beyond to make sure that justice was done because they felt so strongly about the occurrences that the investigation showed them that happened. And I think that's an important fact that people need to be aware of as we go into the next part of the testimony, which is what can we learn from this and what can we do differently. We do have, as next testifiers will talk about, have an immediate reaction, which is something bad happened, but what can we do to prevent this? What can we do to take advantage of this situation to make sure that we do a little bit more to protect elders from abuse? And hopefully that's something that will go forward this session. The other question that I wanted to address here that has come up in the past is there an age issue in the age that we're working in this facility? We did do a survey of all the other states to figure out what's the minimum age. The vast majority of other states have a minimum age similar to Minnesota, which is age 16. The training that's required in our state is about average compared to other states. There certainly are some other states that have more hours of training required. And when I make my final points about money, because I can never go before a committee without asking for money, the training, of course, has a cost if you're going to increase the amount of training. I started my career in long-term care at age 17, and I thought it was a pretty darn good age. I don't think there's any magic age that someone can be better at giving care than another age. There's a maturity level. There's a training issue, certainly, but I don't think there's a magic age. The facility did background checks. Matter of fact, one of the perpetrators, her mother's worked in the facility for 20 years. I mean, it was the daughter of a longtime worker there. Plus, there was, you know, no history. So I do think that there, when you take a look at should we do a minimum age, you're eliminating a good cohort of caring staff the higher you set that bar. Just so that's covered as well. Could there be a way that increased staff would have prevented this? Maybe, if there was more staff coverage. Would better of training prevented this? Maybe. We have looked, the Justice Project is looking at how we can enhance the training that's required of entry-level direct care staff. There will be a cost if you add hours of mandated training, if you add some, you know, human dignity kind of components to the training, or Better yet, if you look at more modern means of interactive type of training, because there are some pilots right now in the state that look at that, which we think have some promise. So there certainly could be. To convert to household models, there was, I believe, an interview with Dr. Kane from the University of Minnesota that said the more we move to culture change and household models, the likelihood of hidden abuse occurring would decrease, because you're essentially working together in small households, you're cooking, you're doing activities with people on a daily basis. That, again, has a cost to implement that. So those are just some cost considerations. Finally, I just want to end by reiterating that the facility was found to have done no wrongdoing in the investigation. When it was identified, they took immediate action. They brought in all the staff that they needed to. They brought an additional team of nurses to do head-to-toe examinations, to do all the things that they needed to do, to immediately put in place protections for the existing residents. They had no deficiencies or state orders were issued as a result of the process they went through, and I want to make sure folks knew that as well. So if you have any questions about that particular facility's circumstances, I could answer those. Otherwise, I'd be turning it over to Carrie to talk about the Mountain View case.
Any questions, members? Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Kahn, I was curious, Mr. Anderson talks about the severity of the penalties. Do we know what these individuals are looking at right now from a penalty, possible penalties?
Well, the discussion, Representative Kelly, Chairman, he said the discussion when the charges were first filed was that ultimately at the end they would likely only be getting probation, and I think the county attorney had been looking at increasing the level of charges. I don't know if that has happened. We will find out next week if they found a higher level of charges that they could charge them with to actually have. The concern with the community is that the girls who were actually charged would only end up having a fine and probation, and they did want them to serve jail time. The county attorney was looking at increasing the charges that were originally filed. So I don't have a specific answer, and I won't until next week. But I can let the committee know after the arraignment next week.
Thank you. Any other questions? Ms. Thurlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for Aging Services of Minnesota. Last session you knew us as the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance, so this is the first appearance of us officially appearing under our new name, Aging Services of Minnesota. I want to echo what Ms. Collin has said at the outset of my testimony, that we agree that not even a single incident of elder abuse is acceptable or tolerable, and we want to echo that and stand committed to, as an association, as our members do, to working with a broad array of Minnesota stakeholders, from consumer advocates to provider organizations, to learning from these incidents, for working to increase public awareness of these issues, and looking at any other ways that can be done, any other methods that can be looked at to prevent any incidents of elder abuse. As my role as the Vice President of Advocacy at Aging Services, I also am sort of standing in as a proxy for the other facility that has been in the news lately. The Luther Haven Care Center in Montevideo has in relatively close proximity to time to the incident that Ms. Collin just described, has also appeared in the news. The administrator, Jim Flaherty, does send his regrets that he was not able to travel in this cold weather to testify, but I've spoken with him and gotten some information as well. And my primary purpose today is to share information about that incident, as well as answer any questions, particularly with regard to current regulations that providers need to meet under current law. Just to first go through some facts with regard to the allegations in Montevideo, it's important to note at the outset that there remains an ongoing investigation in that case by the county attorney. At this time, we don't know if charges will be brought in that case. The county attorney's investigation is ongoing, and as of right now, charges have not been brought. However, the OHSC report investigation has been completed. The OHSC report did substantiate the allegations against the individual in this particular case, and the allegations that were brought. According to the OHSC report, and I'm going to...
Ms. Thurlow, can you just tell us what OHSC is?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's the agency, and I'm bad with acronyms, Mr. Chair, so I'm going to defer to...
You can just tell me what...
It's the agency that investigates reports of the these allegations, but Ms.
Thurlow knows health facility complaints within the Department of Health.
Thank
you. I should have learned my lesson on acronyms from earlier this week, Mr. Chair. According to the OHSC report, since the allegation... of abuse by the identified employee has been substantiated, the report will be submitted to the Nurse Aid Registry for possible inclusion of the finding on the abuse registry, and or it may also be included with the Minnesota Department of Human Services for possible disqualification in accordance with the background study requirements of state law. So again, the report has been completed. It has been forwarded to the Nurse Aid Registry and also to the Department of Human Services, and the actions, the decisions will flow from there based on the requirements of law. The individual, the suspect in this case, is no longer employed at Luther Haven. In fact, the individual has never returned to Luther Haven after the initial report was given to the Director of Nursing. Immediately, that person was asked to leave the facility, has been terminated, and has never returned. It's also important to note in this case that the OHSC report did not find any wrongdoing on behalf of the facility. Luther Haven did not receive a correction order or deficiency related to the situation. So again, this case is in a little bit different stage than the case that Ms. Cullen referred to. It's still, I would say that it's still somewhat in the development stages, both from the criminal side of things as well as elevating to taking additional steps. But as far as the facility is related, they have taken the steps to remove that individual from the facility and have not been found to have committed any wrongdoing, and did act immediately once information about potential abuse was revealed to the Director of Nursing. And with the interest of time, I'm going to concur with much of what Ms. Cullen has said with regard to regulatory and training issues. We are interested in having those discussions, but do want to echo what Ms. Cullen has said with regard to being mindful of potential costs there. If the committee is interested, we did a very quick summary of reporting and training requirements that are in current law, currently imposed on facilities. So if the committee is interested, I'd be happy to walk through that information as well. But I'd also be happy to answer any questions at this time.
Well, Representative Murphy has a question, I know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Thurlow, it's good to see you. The employee at Luther who's been terminated, between now and when the case is adjudicated, is that employee able to go work in another nursing home? Can you talk to us about what happens in this intervening period?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I'm going to take a stab at it and then ask my colleagues also to fill in if they're... At this time, because there's still a decision pending on the nurse registry as well as with the Department of Human Services, I don't know that there has been a determination of disqualification at this time. And I'm not sure of the timing on that. And I'm looking to Ms. Cullen or to my colleague, Mr. Shreve, to see if they can help fill in the blanks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, ideally, once there's a substantiated report, the registry should be notified. There could be a little bit of a lag time. The issue may be, however, that the nursing assistant registry is just for nursing facilities. So could she still be an aide, home health aide? Yes. And until there's actual charges filed in the court of law and a background check, they wouldn't find that if they were a home health agency.
Thank you.
Sure. So, Ms. Thurlow, you said you had a document?
I do have a handout, Mr. Chair, if you're interested. It's a brief summary of only related to reporting as well as training obligations.
Is it something we can just look at, or it's pretty self-explanatory?
It's pretty self-explanatory, but if folks have questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kerber's in the audience. We want to actually discuss what really happens in the long run to folks. So he can comment, because there's some information that you would like to know.
Right. So I'm just thinking, why don't we take the summary, thank you very much, and we can hit that at the next, at one of the first two further testifiers. Any other questions? Well, one question I had, do you have any, are there kind of in your organization any informal, or informal is maybe not the right, model policies that are different from what we do in state law about how to avoid incidents of abuse or neglect or anything that are kind of, that you have put in place or suggest to people?
Well, Mr. Chair, committee members, good segue into the next section of the testimony. We have reporting mandates under the Vulnerable Adults Act, and everyone has their own policies and procedures that mirror the laws and regulations relating to reporting. But they're very complicated, and we do training, and there's retraining, and it's mandatory training that everyone does on reporting obligations. And one of the first things that our facility did was redo that training that they had just done to all staff so they're fully aware of it. But in terms of the warning signs of abuse, that is something that we have been working with the Elder Care Rights Alliance, and we'll talk about the Justice Project that is going to have that information posted everywhere. It's one thing to see it. It's another to see signs that make you think maybe something could be happening. That's where we want to go.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, if I may,
sure.
Aging Services of Minnesota is also involved in that project. And I don't know if Daryl Shreve is an employee with our association. He can also describe some additional steps that our association is taking with regard to some additional training if the committee is interested.
Maybe just a minute or two? Sure. Thank you. Yes. First.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Daryl Shreve. I'm the Vice President for Health Policy with Aging Services of Minnesota. Currently, over the next 2 weeks, we're having a series of meetings, district meetings for our members around the state, and we are presenting information to our members there. We have a nurse consultant who works on our staff who combines, in association with an attorney, a seasoned long-term care attorney, is presenting a program for our members exactly on the lessons learned from these situations and ways to improve training, oversight, education, supervision, things of that sort. We're taking this very seriously. Even though the facilities did absolutely everything they were supposed to under the regulation, we also want our members to think, is there something else we can do above and beyond what we are doing? I think the Vulnerable Adults Justice Project that both speakers have mentioned is also working in those areas, and we're cooperating very heavily in that. The posters and little pocket cards on identifying abuse and reporting it, we're helping fund that effort, and we will distribute those to our members at our institute in February. We'll have approximately 3,000 members, so we're taking very aggressive steps on this. It's very serious.
And the same direction about identifying the warning signs, as opposed to, is that kind of the direction?
Yes, that's definitely in there. The federal regulations also require a certain amount of training on abuse, recognizing it and preventing it, that we're trying to go beyond that. We've been doing... Everybody does that. Every new employee gets an orientation training on the Vulnerable Adults Act and recognizing abuse and the fines and reporting it. But we want to go beyond that, what we've been doing in the past.
And if we could get a set of those materials after, that would be helpful.
Certainly.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Hayden had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Carlin, or whoever can answer this question, I was wondering about the age, so I'm not as familiar with, it sounds like 16-year-olds can be eligible to work in nursing care facilities. Can you talk a little bit more about the age? It seems to me that the level of responsibility that one needs to have in order to give the kind of care that they need to give relative to how old they are, that there's some correlation. So is that, can you just talk about that just a little bit just so that I can understand that?
Ms. Collins.
Certainly. There is no requirement that you be 18. The labor laws in the state say you need to be, 16. You do have to take and pass nursing assistant training course, and that precludes some people from doing that, just because, you have to be able to go to class and go to the training and pass the test. So some folks won't do it, but nursing assistants, as well as dietary aides, there are many times where we use high school students to fill the gaps. It's an ideal job to fill like between 5 and 8 o'clock at night when it's the busiest time in a nursing facility and you just need folks for a few hours. We often use high school students during that period of time to help serve meals, to help get people back to their rooms, to do bathing and cares and those kind of things. That's an intense period of time. So for high school students, we often supplement our staffing levels with high school students during that period of time. I would say, you know, the average age of a nursing assistant is far above 18, but we still do use high school students to fill in the gaps.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Collin, was at the time that the incident happened in Albert Lea, was that during that time frame? Was it during the transitional time, or was it? And I'm not as familiar with the incident in terms of the details. So was it later in the day, or was it around the 5 to 8 p.m. time that this alleged abuse happened?
My understanding, just from talking to the administrator, and I don't believe the report listed specific times, is they work primarily during that shift.
Representative Fritz.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Collin, the certified nurse, those 16-year-old nursing assistants that you just referred to between that time frame, between 5 and 8, doing that amount of work, they are certified nursing assistants who have gone through the nursing assistant program, correct?
Correct, that's correct, okay. Representative Fritz.
And just one comment then on that as a nurse in a nursing home for many, many years, the nurse at that time is extremely busy out on the floor doing her nursing work. And, of course, part of her nursing work is observation of the nursing assistants in her charge. And I think we have to talk about that more in your adult justice. I'm very happy to see this coalition of folks, and because often, and I've said this many, many times, and I hate to repeat myself, but that nurse is out there administering to perhaps 60 people. And she needs to get away from that cart or whatever it is she's doing to get back to find out what these certified nursing assistants are doing behind closed doors. And I'm just saying that there's often times where she is not able to do that because you have one nurse and too many patients. Thank you.
I get Representative Loughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our guests. As we deal with this difficult issue, I think I have fairly good, based on your explanation, understanding what the nursing home industry does in terms of training staff and who they hire and that sort of thing. I know you have to provide a patient's bill of rights to people who enter, but is there training that needs to be done for the resident and or their family about, you know, who to report to, how to recognize those same signs of vulnerability or abuse, because oftentimes their communications abilities oftentimes are very compromised or limited, their cognitive abilities may be limited, but family members sometimes can be the first to notice a change in behavior or something that doesn't seem right. And could you tell us if there's, upon orientation, anything other than, you know, handing off the patient bill of rights to family members and or the person who's staying there?
Ms. Collin?
Go ahead. Representative Loeffler, in most cases, actually, there's so much information given to a resident and their family the first day of admission in a nursing facility that they do give them the bill of rights, but they spend some time over the course of the first few days of admission to go through that with the family. But you're right. One of the things that the Elder Care Rights Alliance, and Mark, sorry about that, I'm taking some of your thunder, they have taken a lot of calls across the continuum of care, from assisted living to home care to nursing facilities from families. And that's why we decided to do this justice project. And there will be posters and there will be cards that will help families take a look at things a little bit closer. And so when their loved one looks, you know, is agitated or has severe behavior changes that are unexplained, that family members who see them every day can say, you know what, something's going on. And that's a new thing that we're going to be doing with our joint education and this justice project, is making sure that in addition to the Bill of Rights that says this is all of the rights you have, the warning signs are things that we haven't done in the past, and I think that's an added value with this unfortunate circumstance that we're going to go forward with.
Representative Rood.
Thank you.
Did you have anything more, Representative Loeffler? I'm sorry. Okay. Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure other people have the same. I really had a visceral response
to this news when it came out. It's just really frightening to me. I have a couple, well, a question I'll try to put it all together. My concern is it's disturbing enough to hear about these cases. I guess I have a concern about cases that may be out there that we're not hearing about. And are there, is there a pathway for people at these various facilities where they feel safe, where they can bring these suspicions and allegations forward? And is that made very clear to them as, you know, for the employee? So that's the one question. The other question follows a little bit on what Representative Murphy's comments. When individuals are, there's some allegations and they're adjudicated, there's really no record then as far as if they go, then they're done, right? I mean, we don't know about these past, I know I'm all over the map here, aren't I? Let me back up. When people come from out of state, is I guess one of the questions I wanted to know. Are there ways for the agencies to get the information when people either within the state and outside of the state of Minnesota? It's a lot, isn't
there's
it?
There's two questions.
There. Right, there are two questions. Right.
Mr.
Chair, Representative Rood, to answer the first question first on the recording requirements and whether there's a safe environment. Again, I think yes, there is a process by which every employee is trained and receives training and knows about is trained to report suspicions and allegations, and the vast majority, I would say the vast majority of circumstances, that reporting procedure is followed, such as the case in Montevideo. I would say that as I understand the allegations in Albert Lea, it's very rare, because you had a group of suspects that were conspiring to keep it under wraps. I think that's very rare. And in most cases, every employee knows of their reporting requirements and do follow those reporting requirements. We have talked in terms in the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project about ways of creating an even greater culture of reporting and making that safe and working through a culture of encouraging that as well. And so we have had those discussions and continue those as well. And then as to the question on background checks, I think is where you're going with your second question, if I can assume.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rood, just to add one more comment to that, one of the things that we also discussed a lot in the Justice Project is to have a, you know, I think something is going on place, but I'm not sure. Because once you actually call the CEP, which is the central place in each county, then the ball starts rolling. And that's the state ombudsman office. So in our materials, we're saying, you know, you have a confidential call. Here's a phone number, an 800 number, that you can call confidentially and ask a question like, you know, so-and-so's acting kind of strange. What should I do kind of thing? So we did talk about that. Before anything has to be formally reported, is there a place to ask a safe question? We're adding that to our materials. The second part of your question is once someone's blacklisted on the registry, they can't work as a nursing assistant in a nursing home anymore. And when they come in from another state, there's not automatic reciprocity. So there is a process. Now, we do have some issues with the background check process that we are continuing to work through, and some of it is a resource allocation issue, frankly, with the state agencies that do it. Some of our members that do private background checks through places like Verified Credentials have many more flags that come up and they can blue slip someone that you wouldn't get just going through the background check process, and also because there's a backlog. So there are some things out there that are causing delays in our background check process, but it's, again, it's another monetary issue, I imagine.
Thank you. Sorry, that was so garbled.
No, thank you. That's good.
Did we get it?
Okay. Mr. Chair?
A follow-up.
So they can't work in a nursing home again, but can they go to work as an assistant in home health in a different type of setting?
The department may know that answer. Mr.
Yeah, the department would know that answer better than I would.
And they're going to be coming down. We'll have participation later. Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Melody Nordby and Rick Varco, welcome.
Chairman Thiessen, members of the committee, my name is Rick Bartle. I'm the political director for SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. We represent 17,000 healthcare workers in Minnesota, including a couple of thousand nursing home workers. We represent the workers at Luther Haven Nursing Home. I'm joined by Melody Nordby. She's a trained medical assistant, an SEIU steward, and a trustee of our union. I want to start just by reiterating the feelings, the visceral feelings that everybody shares. I think that's why I included the letter to the editor that our members from Luther Haven on their own put together and published in their local paper and posted at their own work sites. I think that's testimony to how direct care workers feel about this issue. The incidents at Luther Haven didn't happen because workers, administrators, and inspectors failed to do their jobs. They happened because we have a state, including, you know, let's face it, all of us have failed to invest in the necessary resources in direct care work. Nursing home workers don't need more paperwork. They need the resources to hire quality staff, the time to train them correctly, and incentives to retain those staff. It's ironic to me because I don't think there is any home that we represent that has done more to call attention to this problem than the people at Luther Haven under Melody's leadership. In fact, in the spring of 2005, they, working with us, put together a town hall forum on what they saw as the crisis in long-term care. And I think there was over 150 people there, caregivers, town members, Representative Conan was there. We have a very simple message, I think, on this issue. Adequate staffing equals prevention. Prevention is the most humane, least expensive policy of all, and apparently we're failing. So now I would like to turn it over to Melody to explain the perspective of someone on the ground.
Chairman Thiessen and members of the committee, my name is Melody Nordby. I have worked at Luther Haven for 26 years as a certified nursing assistant and a trained medical assistant. At Luther Haven, we did not lack oversight or accountability. As soon as abuse was discovered, swift action was taken. What caused the abuse? First, one of the persons involved was newly hired. The second had been there less than 2 years. We cannot afford to retain our good trained staff. In the past few years, I have seen too many coworkers I admired and trusted leave for other jobs. They leave for jobs that pay more or are not as dangerous. I helped negotiate our contract, so I know the main problem is that the legislature does not provide enough funds to pay the wages that would keep people working. Working in a nursing home is very dangerous work. Why stay in a job that carries a high risk of serious permanent injury when all you can look forward to is a small pay increase? Last year, more than one-third of our new hires left within a year. The high turnover means that sooner or later you will hire someone who does not have the values that we expect. The faster you turn over, the sooner a bad apple turns up. Second cause is short staffing. In the past, veteran workers like me were able to spend extra time training and monitoring new hires. New hires learned how to treat people with respect and dignity from veteran role models. They acted foolishly. They were soon set to right and watched closely. Now, no one has time to do this extra mentoring. You are so far behind doing your own job that you have no time to watch while someone else does their job. Finally, when we had proper staffing levels, everyone knew that there were a lot of eyes on the floor. Staff knew someone else might pop in at any moment. The best nursing home oversight is caregivers on the floor. If people asked how someone could get away with behavior like this, I would tell them, it is because there is almost no one watching. Again, everyone is too busy taking care of their own residents to keep an eye on someone else. Under current staffing levels, we have time to provide the basic care required and no more. In the past, the average nursing assistant would take care of 6 residents. Now it ranges from 8 to 12, depending upon who shows up. At Luther Haven, we are routinely required to use more expensive school nurses because we cannot hire enough staff. I have been taking care of residents for almost 27 years, and I have never seen such a high turnover and chronic short staffing. Recruitment and retention is difficult due to the differences between the wages a hospital can offer compared to the wages a nursing home can afford. High turnover is costly, and most important, disrupts the continuity in care that our residents deserve. unless the legislature acts to correct these problems, no amount of government oversight will ensure the dignity of our residents. More adequate staffing is the most cost-effective way to provide real nursing home oversight. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, members? Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not a question, but to Ms. Nordby, worked in a nursing home and in a hospital. And, I read the letter from the employees and know what it was like when we discovered among us someone that was working not up to par. And it is devastating, and I hear that in your voice. So I just want to let you know that that's not lost on us. And, you know, just like the rest of us do, that we're facing a crappy budget, excuse my bad language, that being said, I just want you to know that we have a lot of respect for the work that you do and understand that some of the short staffing issues are making it more difficult. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming down. Thank you for coming in from Montevideo, too. Appreciate it. Darcy Miner. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Darcy Miner. I'm the Director of the Compliance Monitoring Division at the State Department of Health, and included in our division are sections with acronyms like LNC and OHSC, and those are the survey part of the agency, which goes in on a regular basis to inspect nursing homes, as well as OHSC, which was identified earlier. It's the Office of Health Facility Complaints. The OHSC staff investigates both complaints and self-reports, and that distinction was made also by a previous speaker that facilities are required to report certain incidents, and in addition, anyone can call in a complaint to OHSC, and we triage them all the same way and attempt to sort them out by priority and then to follow up in one of several ways. One of the things that is reported under the Vulnerable Adults Act is any maltreatment, which includes abuse, neglect, financial exploitation, and unexplained injuries. There is a copy of our last annual report. We submit two annual reports to the legislature each year. One is on the survey side of things, and one is on the complaint side. And so copies of the complaint report are here. I can tell you that it's quite detailed and a little overwhelming, and so I'm going to highlight a couple of pieces for you that I hope are responsive to the issues that you asked me to talk about. For one thing, we were asked if we had seen a trend, and at this point, in each year's report, we include the previous 2 years' statistics as well as the current year. For fiscal years 05 through 07, the numbers were roughly level in the areas of complaints. We had roughly 30 emotional abuse complaints, 62 physical abuse complaints, and in the 3 years we had 14 in the first year, 20 in the second, and 20 in the third year of sexual abuse complaints. And again, that's distinguished from self-reports where a facility may have discovered an incident and then, as required by law, reported it to us themselves. In the self-report categories, there were, in the most recent year, I'm sorry, for the average of those 3 years in the report, there were roughly 171 self-reports from facilities of emotional abuse. The trend in physical abuse we saw going up, and that was 205 reports in 05, 227 in 06, and 251 in 07. The sexual abuse reports actually dropped significantly from 106 reports in fiscal year 05 to 78 and down to 67 in fiscal year 07. There have been some changes that occurred in May of 08 that make it somewhat easier for facilities to do the required self-report, and we made these changes in response to federal oversight of our office, which told us that although facilities were in compliance with the state law, which requires them to report through the common entry point, they were not in compliance with federal law, which requires them to also report within 24 hours of an incident to the state survey agency, which is the Department of Health. So we developed a very, we hastily put together an online reporting system so that facilities can now go online and report those incidents to us. Whether because it's easier to do so or because they know that we are under the spotlight from the federal government, there have been a significant increase in the numbers of self-reports that we've seen since that system was implemented in May, somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 3 times the numbers of self-reports. We are still looking into why that is, and frankly, I think another reason may be that when we go out on our annual review of nursing homes, we compare their in-house incident reports with what we have on record. And so if they were citing that there had been incidents that hadn't been reported to us, we could actually write a deficiency. And so I think in some ways it's also a protective measure on their part that they are over-reporting if they're erring rather than under-reporting. So, again, the report that's due to the legislature this spring will probably show a pretty significant uptick in the number of self-reports of these various areas of abuse. Our role in addressing these reports and complaints is, first, we do have the intake staff that receives those reports either online, through fax, or by phone. They do the initial review and triage the reports and determine which investigative option we will use. We can either decide that there will be no further review or investigation, and that option is sometimes made if it's a self-report from a facility. They tell us, this happened, here's what we did, and we're satisfied that there really wouldn't be anything more that we would expect them to do. The complaint can be handled sometimes as a desk investigation in which we simply call the facility. We may ask for some additional detail about the incident and about the follow-up, and then we still feel that we can close it out. The complaint may be referred to our licensing section, who, as I mentioned, on an average of once a year, go into every nursing home in the state. And so we will forward a concern to them, asking that when they are on site next, that they actually look into that particular incident and follow up to make sure that it's been addressed. And lastly, we can do assign it for an on-site investigation by one of our OHSC nurse investigators. For the same period that the report covers for the state fiscal year 05 to 07, we did on-site investigations of abuse in 80 cases in fiscal year 05, and of those, we substantiated 37. In fiscal year 06, we went on-site in 112 instances of alleged abuse, and we substantiated 58 of those. And in state fiscal year 07, we went on-site to investigate 97 alleged abuses, and we substantiated 30 of those. Quick math, I guess, is somewhere between a third to a half of those that we've actually gone out on-site have ended up being substantiated. We do prioritize them for a quicker review. As has been stated by several people here, certainly we at the Department of Health agree that no type or amount of abuse is acceptable, but we do have to use our resources to address those instances which appear to be the most severe that have actually caused harm or have potential of harm to residents. I suppose what I'm saying there is that if we get an allegation of verbal abuse where someone has spoken harshly to a resident, that may or may not prompt us to send someone out on site, whereas any type of allegation of physical or sexual abuse is far more likely to see us sending an investigator on site. One of the goals that we have is to protect residents from future abuse by following up with those individual perpetrators. And Mr. Kerber will talk a little about some of the details there, but we also look...
And Mr. Kerber, if you want to come on down. No, that's fine.
Come on down.
And also, Susan Winkleman, who is in my division, may need to come up. It gets fairly confusing between the nurse aid registry and the whole background studies, and so we'll try and keep it simple. Did you want Mr. Kerber, Mr. Chairman,
whatever
to speak now?
Whatever makes the most sense.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the director of the licensing division at the Department of Human Services. And I don't have any prepared remarks, but I thought I'd just try and answer some questions about background studies and how this all works. again, I'm from the
department. If it makes sense at this point, just to kind of start the process, you get a complaint in, like a self-reported, well, either one. Mm-hmm. Okay, then what happens, I guess, is the question, right? Okay. So it goes to you first.
Yes,
or
Mr. Chairman.
Your section, yes.
Right.
Okay.
So our intake office would take that complaint, would triage it. It's all then reviewed by a supervisor to make sure that staff have triaged it appropriately, assuming that it's one that we want to assign to an investigator. Generally, the time frame in which that happens is determined more by our federal guidelines, that if we think that it was actually an immediate jeopardy where a resident has been harmed or is in immediate danger of being harmed, we have to go out and investigate that within a shorter period of time. And so we will likely assign it and get someone out within 10 days, and if we think that it's something even more critical, we would send someone out within 2 days. So an investigator goes on site.
So, for instance, Albert Lee was within 2 days, or that would have risen to that kind of.
Yes, it certainly rose to.
Or the 10-day.
To the 10-day investigation. Okay. Yes. Yeah. So we went on site. We go out unannounced. We walk in. We let the administrator know that we're there. We tend not to. We don't share what the allegation is, but we say that we're there to investigate an allegation that's come to us. Generally, a nurse would be on site for a day to 2 days, interviewing people and investigating. In an incident like Albert Lee, where there were many more alleged perpetrators, it was a far more complicated investigation and took longer than what we normally do. But so we would do the investigation. We would say, and that would be including interviewing the residents and perhaps other residents. We do, under federal protocol, we actually expand the sample, is what it's called. And so instead of looking only at the one resident and the one incident that was reported, we also look to find other residents who are similarly situated, whether they receive care from the same alleged perpetrator or whatever it is that makes them similar. And so we try and look at more than just the one case. When we are done with our investigation, and let's say that we find that we are going to substantiate the allegations that abuse took place, the kind of the next point that we look at is, was this an instance where we're holding the facility liable for, or was it just the individual? And so you've heard a lot about the training that's offered, the oversight that's offered, and if by the time that we've looked at this incident, if we believe that the facility either had already done everything they could reasonably be expected to do, or that they've corrected since the time that they first learned of the incident, we would likely not write a deficiency against the facility at that time. That's still a distinction between that we would then complete our report and indicate that we have substantiated the allegation of abuse. So if we would take it then to that individual where we substantiate that abuse took place and we determine that it is the individual and not the facility that's responsible, and do you want to pick it up? The nurse aid registry. Okay, and so yes, it would depend on the type of employee, and if it were a nurse or another professional, we send them the notice and we put on there that we are going to notify that professional board. So the Board of Nursing gets all the reports that include substantiated allegations that involve a nurse. For nurse aid, we would notify the nurse aid registry, and that was discussed in some generalities before. Susan, do you want to take it from here? Welcome to the committee. We're over here now.
Thank you.
We're back over there now.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Winkleman. I'm the Assistant Division Director in the Division of Compliance Monitoring in the Health Department. Dorothy has left me in a place where I know just a little bit more, so maybe I'm about 5 minutes that I can share some information. But when we have a result that is substantiated maltreatment or abuse, and it's against an individual, then there are two primary places the report goes. Dorothy talked about it going to the Board of Nursing if it's against a nurse. And then also, if it's a nursing assistant, it would be reported to our nursing assistant registry, which the department is responsible for having. And the nursing assistant registry is a requirement that comes from federal law to the health department, and it's something that all nursing assistants in the state have to meet certain qualifications and training, and then their names get published on this nursing assistant registry, and if there's any maltreatment against them, it gets listed on it as some sort of filter. And then once that gets listed on the nursing assistant registry, then they are barred from employment in a nursing home. There are appeal procedures, and that does slow down the process or mean that there's a lag time in it actually getting onto the nursing assistant registry itself. But we do in Minnesota have the benefit of the Vulnerable Adults Act and the disqualification process in DHS, which Mr. Kerber can talk about, that supplements or hurries up that process whereby the nursing assistant would be disqualified from working in a nursing home.
And just a couple quick questions on the registry. So first of all, what about inconclusive? It has to be substantiated, so if it's inconclusive or not substantiated, then it doesn't go anywhere further, is that right?
That's my understanding, that it would have to be substantiated, right.
Okay, and the question that, I'm not sure which person asked the question, but about beyond nursing homes. So I just don't understand the nursing assistants, are they only in nursing homes or can they be in home health care as well?
They can, I believe, I'm getting into an area where I'm hesitating. I've been in my position for a year, so I'm okay. Still on a learning curve, but I don't know.
Oh, maybe you, Mr. Oh, Kerber. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
And again, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the director of the licensing division of the Department of Human Services. And while we're in a different agency, a lot of this workflow is pretty seamless. We're very, very connected with each other, and we share database and things like that. But in the Department of Human Services, we do the background studies for all the programs that are licensed by Human Services, and all of the services that are licensed by the Department of Health as well, and the Department of Corrections, and we do some for the courts. Just a little more background, we do about 1,000 a day on all of these people that work in the healthcare industry and in human services. And so when we get this report over from the health department that has their substantiated maltreatment that identifies an individual as being responsible, there's also a recommendation on that report as to whether or not the health department's review would suggest that this is serious or recurring maltreatment. And serious or recurring is important because those are the criteria in our background study law that dovetails very closely with all these other laws, the Vulnerable Adult Act, the Maltreatment of Minors Act, our Licensing Act, their Licensing Act, and the Data Practices Act. Serious and recurring maltreatment is a disqualification. And so when we get that, then we immediately look at it, and if it's serious or recurring maltreatment, then we issue a notice of disqualification. And so we'll order the person removed from that facility where the maltreatment occurred, but at the same time, we're also looking to see whether or not we've done a background study on that person for any other facility in the state. And if so, we contact that facility to see if they're also working there currently.
There's a lot of mobility within the healthcare industry, and we've heard about some of the turnover, but we're tracking all of that through our background study system. And so we then contact those facilities to find out if the person is still there. And then if so, then they're disqualified from those other arrangements too. And it could be a licensed home health agency. It could be an unlicensed personal care provider organization. It could be a Department of Human Services that licensed DD waiver site or adult foster care. It could be virtually anywhere. And we're going to know that from our background study system. And then importantly, anytime that person goes to seek another job in another first facility, like another nursing home or a hospital or any other program, the requirement for the background study is that that comes through us again, whether it's even a Department of Corrections license program, the background study is going to come through us, and then we're going to be reviewing that data again, and then we'll be issuing those notices of disqualification. And when we get it from the health department, you know, I think there was a mention of some appeal rights. People have the right to appeal whether or not the Department of Health's finding of maltreatment was the right finding. What we do is we get our notice of disqualification out as quickly as possible so that all of these appeals can be consolidated together at one time. So they're appealing their disqualification, they're appealing their maltreatment finding. It's all consolidated into one hearing whenever we can possibly do that. So it's a pretty kind of seamless system, even though it's involving a couple of agencies here.
Mr. Neighbor.
Just one question. We actually worked in this consolidation like 8 years ago or right. Something. So there's only one pass to the gauntlet and you're done. So if the employer wouldn't have fired those people, the person who would have known they were in trouble was from the letter from you saying they can't work anymore. Is that right? So when the DHS would have sent a letter of disqualification, then they would be terminated by you pretty much, right?
No, I can't really talk about this in the individual case, but certainly there are cases where we learn of substantiated maltreatment and the employer has not terminated the person. In many cases they have, but it isn't always the case. And so what we send out two notices. One is to the employer and one is to the individual. And the employer is notified the person is disqualified. The person isn't, and this is the same system that we look at criminal histories and things like that. So it's not every case where the individual is ordered removed from that setting. Many they are. They might be ordered to have supervision during that interim period when they can appeal it. But sometimes it's the employer has not taken the action, but we order it.
Thank you. Representative Rood, and then I think we'll move on to the last set of testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do personal care attendants fall into the same process?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rood, yes, they do. Personal care attendants, there will be a legislative auditor's report coming out pretty soon that's going to talk about that. And yes, personal care attendants, personal care assistants, they all fall into the same background study system that we operate. Even those affiliated with an agency that is not licensed.
Thank you. Did you have anything more you wanted to add? Okay. Let's just do it. So thank you very much. We'll just do a few more minutes here, and then like maybe 2 minutes if we could.
Mr. Chairman, I will wrap it up in 2 minutes. I just wanted to also respond to some of the other questions that we were asked, and one of them was, does the Department of Health encourage any particular safety or abuse prevention techniques? And so I wanted to mention that there is another handout there that has several of the links to our website. And so there was training that we offered by video conference last spring, and all of the materials that we used at that time are on our website, and so those are available. The penalties that are in place, I think we've pretty much covered. I guess the only other comment I would make is, again, to repeat what someone else said, which is that we are trying to track whether there's anything new that we've heard. And one of the things that was new with the Albert Lee case, in addition to the fact that there were multiple perpetrators, was also perhaps because they were young, but in any case, that there apparently was some, that was the first case that made us aware of the use of cell phones and the camera opportunities that are on those. And though I personally can't take pictures with my own phone. I know my kids can take videos. And so we have received, actually our intake staff has alerted us that we've received probably 4 or 5 additional complaints that have come in the past few months alleging similar things where there was, whether it was verbal abuse of residents and people taking pictures of those agitated residents. And so we have shared that information with the associations just to let them know. At this point, we don't have a real good cure for that. And frankly, I don't think that that is necessarily about age. I just think that people who have the technology, and so the associations have taken that information and shared it with their members, and I'm sure that as we hear of any other new trends or concerns, we certainly will share those as well as through the Justice Project that's also been referenced.
Well, thank you for coming today.
You're welcome. That's helpful.
Okay, Mr. Wandersby and everyone else, please come down. Okay. Welcome. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mark Wandersby, the Executive Director of the Elder Care Rights Alliance. And thank you for the invitation to talk today about our Vulnerable Adult Justice Project. I want to read a couple of paragraphs to create the segue for the work that we've been doing for over 15 months here in Minnesota. The silence is deafening when an abused, vulnerable adult doesn't have a voice. Last month, allegations of nursing home residents' abuse surfaced in 2 Minnesota communities. As a result of this news, some families and seniors have begun to question their trust in nursing home care and express new fears of abuse. The allegations as described in the complaints are appalling, yet they serve as a reminder about the responsibility we all must take in caring for our spouses, parents, and grandparents. As leaders of organizations that serve older and vulnerable adults, we are united and have a combined effort in support of the larger reform for the prevention of elder abuse. The Vulnerable Adult Justice Project work is that to strengthen the Vulnerable Adult Act, which was started back in 1980 and was not begun in response to the Albert Lee case or any recent headlines. The Vulnerable Adult Act is a law that needs to be reviewed and revised periodically because society is changing. There's more community care. There's a greater spectrum of long-term care that's not just institutionalized. Professional practice standards are improved over time, for example, assessments and detection, and new technology allows us to streamline systems. A single common entry point or simultaneous dual reporting are some of those features. With respect to the cases that have drawn recent media attention, the actions being charged are violations of current law. The cases do illustrate, however, that how important it is to have adequate mentoring and monitoring of nursing home staff in a culture that respects the dignity of individual residents and co-workers. While our individual organizations oftentimes have different perspectives and may even occasionally disagree on public policies, we have no disagreement when it comes to abuse of older and vulnerable adults. We share a common goal of increasing awareness and prevention of elder abuse with zero tolerance. What I would like to do is direct your attention to a handout that was provided to you, talking a little bit about that Vulnerable Adult Justice Project initiative. We assembled a stakeholder group, approximately 14 months ago in November of 2007, where we brought together the provider side of the equation, public agencies, nonprofit organizations, consumer advocacy groups, the Department of Health, the Department of Human Services, several of your county attorney offices, and various other associations, to the tune of about 52 organizations. And the amount of hours that were put in, there were approximately 10 monthly meetings that were the large stakeholder group meetings. And from those, we vetted the process with over 10 subcommittees that broke out the reporting process, the protection process, the criminal code, and several other components within that, the educational component as well. Those 10 subcommittees invested a lot of time and energy in vetting the process to make sure that we haven't left any stone unturned to identify where those gaps exist and how we can protect those that are unable to protect themselves. through that process, we've now come to that turning point where the research and development phase has turned into two action items. And the action item that Patty will talk about is that public awareness campaign that is done in part to offset the current allegations that are existing in our communities that the media has picked up on and has created global awareness not only to Minnesota nationwide, but also into those small communities where everybody says it can't happen here. So that Vulnerable Adult Justice Project then, through the vetting process, identified those areas insightful to the fact that we have a fiscal shortfall, is to look at those items that we could maybe make changes that would be budget neutral. And those are centered around protecting vulnerable adults from financial exploitation, responding to emergencies when vulnerable adults are missing and endangered, streamlining the vulnerable adult reporting process and system, and then ensuring social services and justice for a growing and changing population by updating what that training looks like, the avenues by which those individuals can receive that training. And all I would like to say is we calculated a rough number in about 1,000 hours just at those large monthly group meetings were invested by the different professionals that sat around those tables to vet the process. So we have something that's very comprehensive and well underway to ensure the safety of vulnerable adults in Minnesota. Patty, with that.
Thank you. Patty Cullen, Care Providers of Minnesota. I'm going to draw your attention to, you should have in your packet, an example hot off the press of the card that we're distributing, as well as the pocket card. The leaders of the organizations that participating and contributing financially to the development and the printing of these cards are both providers and consumer groups, and we did start meeting and decided that as a complement to all the legislative work that's being done, one of the steps that was missing was the awareness campaign. How do we get the word out to everyone? So we made sure the Home Care Association was part of it, the Alzheimer's Association, AARP, thinking of points of contact in the community, not to just put this up on the bulletin board of a nursing facility or for social workers to give it out, but to make sure it's more widely distributed. So we are actually formally announcing this tomorrow at a press briefing and providing the information, but we will also be starting the mass distribution of this information after tomorrow. And one of the questions earlier I want to emphasize here, the early confidential discussion is what's most important, we believe, and that's the whole start of the warning signs, and I thank the Elder Care Rights Alliance, because this was taken right from their website as a tool saying, you know what, here's the key information I think will make the difference going into the future, especially in the non-nursing home settings where you may not have the potential oversight of other staff. And that's one of the areas where we thought, you know, we want to make sure that families get access to this, so we have thousands of these. So, frankly, if any of you want some for your own offices as you're doing constituent visits, we would be glad to share those with you as well if you'd like to distribute those. Jane.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jane Okramovic, and I'm a volunteer with the Alzheimer's Association Minnesota North Dakota chapter. I was also a consumer of long-term care services for my mother, who was in a nursing home for 8 years. She died of complications of Alzheimer's disease in June of 2005. Because of this connection and the use of services in long-term care, I'm particularly concerned when I read about or I hear of maltreatment of individuals with dementia. I'm going to refer to a comment I didn't have. You realized on all the reports that came out, those in particular were targeted because they could not report, and if they did, perhaps they weren't going to be believed. Over the past 13 years, I've learned a great deal about the proper care of persons with some form of dementia. The Alzheimer's Association has published guidelines and offers training courses on these principles, and many of these organizations that were here use this, and our training is available. And we know that appropriate training of staff, especially those caring for residents with dementia, is crucial for good care. Behavioral cares differ from physical ones. The worker needs to know how to approach the problems properly. Obviously, in addition to the proper training the staff needs, good supervision, which you've heard about today. One of my concerns is when we are not in a nursing home setting, in some of the community settings, it is going to be more difficult, and that's why these awareness signs are going to be very important for family members. Observing the care of a resident assures early intervention before a problem becomes too big or a pattern leads to abuse, whether that abuse is physical or emotional. Just as important, however, is this continuity of care. And you heard earlier from the staff person who said they do not keep their workers very long. The turnover is great. Staff needs to know the residents that they're able to interpret those signs when an individual is in pain or may be thirsty. So consistent staffing is a hallmark of a facility that cares about quality care, and certainly not just a facility, but any organization who hires care staff. It also means there must be a safe level of staffing. Working short, you've heard about that today as well, as it's called, is a recipe for disaster, and that applies both to the resident and as well as to the worker. This is often when accidents occur because the CNA is rushing to finish personal cares or putting the person to bed, but is called to take care of someone else. We recognize that people who work in long-term care facilities usually do not receive adequate compensation, and they often have to work two or three jobs to survive, or they may work double shifts. Unfortunately, sometimes that's not always by their choice, however, because, again, they're working short, and staffing problems occur. It is no wonder that these people who are in the trenches, workers, cannot afford their health care insurance. This is a profession, and we should treat it as such. One of the most difficult decisions that we have to make is whether or not to place a loved one in a facility. It is agonizing. Choosing the right place is a daunting task. Family members want, and we need to know, that when we make that decision, our mother, husband, grandfather, or sister will be cared for by a staff who know what to do, and that staff is supported by their administration in providing quality care to all. My mission is to protect the vulnerable adult in whatever setting she finds herself. Thank you for my opportunity to express my concerns, and it's for this reason that I have wholeheartedly support the Justice Project.
Mr. Chair,
yeah,
I would like to add Deb Holtz, State Ombudsman for the Office of Ombudsman from Long-Term Care. We are hoping that she would be finished testifying with her ombudsman report to the Veterans Committee in the Senate today. Unfortunately, I don't see her in the audience. And one of the questions that had surfaced earlier, I believe it was by Representative Broad, is the whole aspect of where do you go with that information, how is it deciphered, and how is it split out. We are very thoughtful in our process of identifying, reporting it, and stopping it. When you look at the marketing message, if you will, behind the whole poster campaign process, is it clearly spells that out, that the ombudsman has officially and in print in many numbers has agreed to field those confidential calls before that process begins that Patty Cullen had spoken of earlier in terms of being able to say, you know, this just doesn't look right. So the ombudsman has that opportunity. At the same time, since they work in a confidential capacity representing that individual's rights as a advocate, they have that opportunity to go into that facility to review the charts, to go through their normal procedural protocol that they do on a day-to-day basis in a very confidential manner. And if something should happen to raise their eyebrow, they would be able to act on it. That second piece that's so important is that reporting piece, to reaffirm for those individuals that are mandated reporters that it is okay to report and that they don't stand alone. And then that last piece of it, of stopping it, is providing or finding out more prevention type strategies, or if you've been victimized, that there are victim services available through our agency.
So how does a safe place to call interact with the mandatory reporting requirement?
Sure, Mr. Chair, committee members. You're mandated to report if you see something, you know something. But if you see some of the warning signs on here and someone's just acting funny, but you never saw anything, that's where it would come in. You call the ombudsman and you say, you know, so-and-so all of a sudden is sleeping all the time. There's no abuse, neglect, or anything to report. You haven't seen anything, but you're suspicious of something. So it's the pre-step before you would be required to actually make a formal report.
And in that circumstance, then, is it to, for the ombudsman or ombudsperson, I suppose, to give advice to that person, or do they actually go out and advocate for the individual patient?
My understanding, and I wish Deb were here to say this, is that they likely have to triage. They do a lot of phone advice, and if there's a circumstance where there's enough information through the discussion that they think they have to actually be on site, that's when they would go. But they have to triage according to their resources.
Mr. Chair, may I add a little bit to that answer? And that whole inquiry, that confidential inquiry, I think that's one of those missing pieces to the puzzle that mandated reporters don't know. They may understand what the warning signs are, especially for an individual that has been victimized as part of sexual assault. When you look through the reports and through the complaint process, the individuals that were perpetrating those vulnerable adults in Albert Lea were very strategic and very bullying in their behavior. And whether there was or was not that management piece, it's more important that there were other coworkers that saw those warning signs, but they couldn't pinpoint it to fit within the parameters of being a mandated reporter. And as a result, what do I do with that information? Mm-hmm. I can't witch hunt my coworkers. But if I know what those warning signs are, the behavior changes, the crying out, the individual not wanting to leave the nurse's station, or saying, get that individual away from me, and all of those other types of warning signs that are there, that staff member that observed that behavior could have called the ombudsman office and said, you know, this is what's happening with Helen today, and I don't know where to go with that. Bam. That triage process can go into play, and that ombudsman can get into that facility and start finding out what's different about Helen's behavior today, what's going on, and kind of raising that awareness.
Perfect timing.
Perfect timing. Come on up, Deb.
Representative Hayden has a question.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, it's really perfect timing if I wanted to ask an ombudsman question, so I'm just hoping here. How many ombudsmen are there, or ombudsperson are there in the state?
Good afternoon. They didn't put those moving sidewalks in yet from the Capitol. So I apologize. My name is Deb Holtz, and I'm the State Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, congratulations, first of all.
Thank you.
There are currently only 12 ombudsmen to serve the entire state of Minnesota, and one of those ombudsmen is actually full-time at the Minneapolis Veterans Home, so we are actually grossly understaffed. The national recommendation to support people is actually one ombudsman per 2,000 people who receive long-term care services, and in Minnesota we're at about a 1 to 9,000 ratio. So that's a good question.
Okay, just one follow-up. So you have 12 staff today, one at the Veterans Home.
Correct.
And then of the 12, are all of those positions filled, or are any of those open today?
We have one additional position where someone just retired, and we are actually holding that open because of budget limits right now. So we do have one vacancy.
So you have 11 with one full-time at the Veterans Home?
Correct. 12 total, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Holtz.
How many complaints do you get?
We Mr. Chairman, we average, our last annual report showed us receiving 2,000 validated complaints, which means that there are complaints that we follow up with and we actually investigate. We get a lot more than that just in inquiries. We typically serve anywhere between 30 and 40,000 people a year just in terms of consultation, providing information, direction about where they can receive services, etc.
President Dowell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, what are we doing right now to encourage things like whistleblowing? The thought occurred to me when this story first hit the media about the specific instance that attracted so much attention. Where were the good workers or the others who may have been noticing this? And what are we doing to both encourage and incentivize these people to blow the whistle on bad operators, bad employees?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's an excellent question. One of the things that we're doing is actually launching, if you want to call it, a media blitz starting tomorrow. There will be, I think you may have already heard about it, the press briefing. One of the things that we want people to know about is that our office, for example, is completely confidential. About 35% of the calls that we get during the year are from residents, but about 42% of our calls that we get are from family, friends, or staff that work in facilities. Staff can call it confidentially. They can say, I know something is going on. We need to encourage those calls, first of all, to let people know that there's complete confidentiality. Nothing will happen to you. But secondly, we will come out and we will visit. Right now, we don't have the staff to have a presence in every home, but we will follow up on those calls. And I think that's one of the things that we need to recognize in the Albert Lee situation. Many, many people did the right thing once they knew about it. However, it's also very important to remember that this was going on for at least 6 months that we know about, and people heard rumors. Now, our office is not condoning rumors, gossip, or witch hunts, but our office is encouraging people to think about, if you hear something, if your gut tells you something, something is probably happening. You need to investigate and follow up and get the facts before any kind of complaint is substantiated. But if you hear things, something is probably going on. Call our office and we will follow up. That may not be enough to make it a mandated report, but call our office and follow up. Excellent question.
Any other questions, members? Okay. Well, thank you for coming, and I'm assuming we're going to be seeing more information about, maybe this goes to civil justice, though, I suppose, your legislation?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
And thank you, members, for your attention today. I mean, this obviously is an issue of deep and kind of visceral concern, as Representative Rood said, and something we're going to have to keep a much closer eye on, although I would say that it's probably something that's more prevalent in our society in general, not just in the nursing homes, kind of a lack of respect for other people, and also, I think, reflected in how we've been doing our state budgeting in recent years. And so I think as we move through this budget process, some of these things, clearly the testimony today shows that it is partly as a result of a lack of investment we've made in our common institutions, and we need to really keep that in mind as we go forward this year. So with that, please save anything you have in your folders that you want to save. Next week, again, we're starting at 3:15 on Tuesday, so it's the inauguration. We're going to come back and talk about the counties, kind of do further reports on county outcome measures. So we circulated some information about that. I think even with the governor's state of the state today, he mentioned some discussion about the relationship between the state and local governments and counties in particular, and I think this is going to be an issue we'll want to pay a close attention to this year. So I hope you look at that stuff beforehand, and we can have some good discussion in the hour that we have next Tuesday. And then next Wednesday and Thursday, Representative Liebling has some hearings that she's going to hold on a variety of couple of issues. And so that's what's coming next week. Thank you. Oh, yeah, and if you have questions about the county stuff that you'd like the department to answer, we'll get those. I mean, some of it, we forwarded some questions today about this. Get that to Kate, and she'll forward that to the department so we can have a better discussion. Thank you. We're adjourned.